And then we also have a group of ETFs that are focused on income. Been in a very low interest rate environment for quite some time. While interest rates are moving up, they're still historically low. So we have different types of funds that are equity based for the most part that provide a higher level of income that investors are looking for, particularly with changing demographics and the aging population. And as people retire, they need more consistent dividends. And we have a whole group of ETFs that fall into that category. We also have international ETFs, China consumer ETFs, different China sectors in China, as well as many other countries, whether it be Nigeria, Colombia, Portugal. I'm tired of hearing about the IPO, all of the ways that all the cash could flow. It would be nice if it would go down to the people on the other side of town. Just don't care. I don't want to be a billionaire. No, I don't. No, I don't want to be a billionaire. Living through the life, don't want to sacrifice my life. Trying to shave 5 seconds off your guideline. Think of something that the whole world needs. That's the best food delivery. Into outer space. No, 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 no. Okay. No school teachers living wage. I know nothing's gonna come from.
This is Alex Wise on Seachange Radio, and I'm speaking to John Mayer. He is the chief investment officer for Global X ETFs. So, speaking of some of these disruptive industries, let's turn to the EV market, the electric vehicle space. Specifically, I'm thinking about how China is adopting electric vehicles in record numbers now, and it's really transformed the global market for EVs, and we're seeing supply chain issues in things like lithium batteries. What can we glean from the ETF markets about China's transition to electric vehicles, John?
First, let's look at why there's been such great adoption of electric vehicles in China. China is very close to the supply chains. So that, I think, is a big driver of the adoption. And the adoption has been about 53% of all cars sold in China are EV sales.
That's in 2021, right?
2021. In comparison, the U.S. penetration is approximately 5%. And being close to the supply chain, combined with incentives from the government, as well as a need to bring down pollution, particularly in, say, Beijing, this all catapulted sales in China. Now, if you think about how it impacts the rest of the world, well, you look at the U.S., we only have a 5% penetration, but we just had a bill that was passed in Congress and signed by Biden that is really going to help the transition to clean energy. There's a lot of incentives in the bill that will, whether it be tax credits for individuals buying EVs, charging stations, the push forward to rejigger factories to make them more environmentally friendly. There's a lot of components of the bill which will drive a lot of other businesses. So it's projected that $3.5 trillion will be spent alongside that bill over the next 10 years that will help move us towards a cleaner energy transition. And with that, you'll get a greater adoption of electric vehicles. I think that's a big play from this bill. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the ETFs, my company has a couple ETFs that focus on whether it be lithium production and battery production, or the companies that utilize batteries and sell electric cars. So there's two ways to kind of play that. You can play the commodity component, lithium. Lithium is in short supply, and it's in great demand. So obviously prices are going up. It takes a while to mine lithium. And going back to China, while they're closer to the supply chain or own some of these lithium companies. So that's very helpful.
And can we kind of connect the dots with what you were just saying and figure out if there's going to be a stranglehold with U.S. adoption because of this boom in China? Can we see signs from the ETF market that, let's say, a particular rare earth mining ETF has gone off the charts? Something that tells me that American consumers are not going to be able to afford Tesla batteries for their solar, rooftop solar systems or whatever, because I know those have almost doubled in the last couple of years. Little pieces of this puzzle can throw everything off.
Biden's historic climate bill, I think, benefits two key areas. One is electric vehicles and one is solar, and that's because some of the tax credits that consumer will receive. Now, this innovation was already started. I mean, there is obviously Tesla has 60% of the EV market, but there's a lot of new players coming into the market. Rivian, as well as many of the other mainstream players, are all producing electric vehicles. And some of them are expensive. They've become cheaper with the tax credits, but there are less expensive EVs. And as the distance traveled on a battery charge increases, I think the usage will increase and the tax credits help. And I don't think it's too dissimilar on the solar side, because there's been this driving force towards clean energy for the past decade, and some of the tax incentives will help going forward. And energy prices are so high.
This is Alex Wise on CJ Radio, and I'm speaking to John Mayer. He is the CIO, the Chief Investment Officer for Global X ETFs. So John, at the outset, you were putting the ETF exchange traded fund market in context and giving us an idea of just how big it is. You said it's over $10 trillion. Can you give us an idea of how the demographics have evolved in this space? I imagine it started off with a much younger group of investors, and now it's become more mainstream, comparable to the way, let's say, mutual funds evolved from the 70s to the late 90s.
Well, I think I would look at it a little bit differently, Alex. So if you think about some of the original ETFs that came into it, SPY, MDY, SPY is an ETF that tracks the S&P 500. It is the single most, or the largest single security that exists on planet Earth, SPY. And it was created primarily for use by institutions to either monetize cash, to just park in an exposure while they're looking for something else, do quick trades. And it was a very efficient way to buy a basket of 500 securities. Out of SPY came others. Something similar on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, one on the Mid-Cap Index, one on the NASDAQ.
So what year are we talking about here, John?
1993 was the first ETF, and that was SPY. And since then, right now, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, we have over 2,000 ETFs in the U.S. Now, at first, they were fashioned after major indexes and well-utilized indexes. And there was a large amount of institutional use. And over time, there became more and more ETFs that tracked many different indexes. And indexes were created so that an ETF could follow that index. And there was an education process to financial advisors to how to effectively use these ETFs. So one of the big things that I do, create portfolios at GlobalX. So what I do is I take many different ETFs and put them together based off a client's risk tolerance and time horizon. I have these incredible tools. I call them like almost fintech instruments that I utilize, ETFs, exchange-traded funds, because they're very tax efficient. The fees are generally lower than a mutual fund, and they're transparent. I know what's inside of these.
Right. So can you tailor one for the fossil-free sector or the gun-free sector, like you said earlier?
Well, I can tailor a portfolio and pick an ETF that best fits a particular client's profile, using these pieces, these building blocks, these Lego pieces, to build a broader portfolio. As an investor wants a well-balanced portfolio. They may want stocks, they want commodities, they want fixed income. All of that can be accomplished by buying an ETF.
So the ESG space, the Environment Social Governance Sector, which for a long time was called corporate social responsibility or just the green investing space, but now it's known by this moniker ESG. How do you have capability or flexibility to be able to create ESG-focused instruments for investors, John?
Well, the ESG topic is broad, and we go on for weeks and weeks discussing it. But in terms of an exchange-traded fund, and in creating an exchange-traded fund or using one, there's two main ways to look at this space. One is looking at through an exclusionary screen. So there's different providers, whether it be MSCI or S&P or Russell, that'll screen companies for things like equality. Are they making things that are harmful to the environment? And they could take them out of those companies out of an index. So say you have the S&P 500, but there could be 50 or 60 companies by your definition of what ESG is, which it does vary. Those companies should not be included in this because they are not considered ESG. So that's one way of getting an index, excluding companies. Another way would be to start from the bottom up, including companies that meet certain values. You look at different stakeholders. You look at employees, suppliers, stockholders, customers, and do some sort of survey to find out the companies that, by your definition, this index should be included in that index. So you're looking, it's a deeper dive and a harder and more comprehensive way of including companies within an index. So those are two ways that you can create indexes and then use an ETF to replicate that index within the ESG space.
He's the Chief Investment Officer of Global X ETFs, John Mayer. John, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It was a lot of fun.
I'm joined on SeaChange Radio by Raj Thermathiram. He is one of the pioneers of the responsible investment field in the UK. He's a board director and senior advisor to several nonprofits in the space. Raj, welcome back to SeaChange Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex. I'm very pleased to be back.
As I mentioned, you're one of the earliest experts in the responsible investing field. It's changed names many times. Why don't you first summarize the arc and the evolution of the space briefly, if you can?
Well, it's a great starter question. So in most countries, it started off as a ethical or personal values or personal based thing. And so, for example, in the USA, I think most people first heard about it in relation to apartheid South Africa and not investing in that. That can also be extended to dealing with tobacco or any other sector or company that individuals don't like. From there, it morphed a bit, as you were saying, into something which was more institutional or retail as a product, and then it became known as socially responsible investing, where people start investment professionals started to look for good companies. Best in class is the technical jargon. Companies that are doing better, even if they're in a dirty sector. So, for example, without naming names, you can look for fossil fuel companies which are trying to support the Paris Agreement and invest in those and disinvest or divest from companies who haven't. That's probably the most extreme example of the challenge in terms of finding best in class. And then most recently, we've had a range of other players come into the sector who are looking for outperformance. So people are trying to integrate non-financial or extra-financial data into their traditional investment performance. Processes to find a competitive advantage.
And you've been a senior advisor at organizations like the university's superannuation scheme, which is a large UK-based pension fund. But that was a while ago. Get us up to date with how larger behemoths of the investment world, whether they be pension funds or hedge funds, private equity. How are they adopting ESG into their vocabulary, Raj?
Great question. When I joined the responsible investment field, I was one of a relatively small number, a handful of professionals in large organizations. Mine was a big pension fund called the University Superannuation Scheme. It's the UK equivalent to TIA CREF in the States. And from there, I went to be the head of ESG or responsible investment at AXA, which is a very big global insurance-based fund manager. Since that time, we've had organizations like BlackRock and State Street and private equity firms like KKR all signing up to being members of an organization called the Principles of Responsible Investment. So depending on how you classify it, between 1 in 3 or even 1 in 2 investment dollars is now signed up those principles on paper. How in practice that gets executed is a very big question. There's a lot of concern about greenwashing.
Yes, I can't help but think a lot of times when I hear the stats being bandied about that the ESG sector has gone from $150 billion to $2 trillion in the last how many years. I can't help but think that that's just that they're moving the goalposts a lot in many cases, that these companies aren't necessarily completely changing the way they do business, but the way we analyze green investing has changed. Is that overly harsh?
So I'm going to say yes and no. The concern is absolutely right. I have been talking about it for over 10 years. It's one reason I went independent and set up my own think tank. It's much easier to say what you think when you're not wearing an organizational hat. So where you're absolutely right, Alex, is that it's very easy to slap a label of ESG on a fund, which isn't different from the funds that didn't used to be called ESG. So you do a tiny bit of divestment, you take out tobacco here, you overweight companies which have a good carbon footprint, and suddenly, wham, bam, you've got a ESG fund. Well, actually, the real world value of that is pretty minimal, if anything. So that's one problem. The other problem is a lot of very big fund managers are doing what they do best, which is to push products. So on top of their normal business, they've added a new set of products called ESG products. Well, that's a bit like, I don't know, having some extra salad, but at the same time stuffing yourself with high-carb fizzy drinks and unhealthy food. It doesn't change the real impact of those organizations. And so I have some big questions about the greenwashing that's allowed in the sector at the moment.
Raj Thermathiram, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alec Wise. Additional music by The Meters and Theo Katzman. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
Hi, this is Walt Perezader with the group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO-FM.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What this does is this hands back, and that's why the phone itself becomes the instrument that is the accurate navigation device, because in your phone, you now have the freedom to explore.
Have you ever watched amazement as a visually impaired person nimbly maneuvers their way through a crowded subway station? Well, some thoughtful innovations are being developed to enable people with low vision to navigate the world with greater ease. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to the founder and CEO of Waymap, Tom Pei, about his startup company's breakthrough navigation technology. We discuss his company's product, look at some of the challenges that people with disabilities face, and touch upon the promise of autonomous vehicles for those without sight. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Tom Pei. He is the CEO of Waymap. Tom, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the journey that you and your colleagues have had with Waymap, what the mission of the organization is, and what problems you're trying to solve with it?
Basically, we started out trying to solve a very simple problem. It was the 7 blind young people in London said the most important thing to them to help them to change their lives for the better was to be able to get around London Underground like everyone else. And the reason for that was that they were young. They had, a couple of them had just been out on a date with a boyfriend or a girlfriend. They had been taken around by these adults, strangers, sighted guides to help them to navigate the Underground. And that wasn't very cool. So they thought, hey, you know, an app could solve this for us. I had done some research on it previously, so I put my hand up and said, God, solve that problem for you. We applied to google.org and we got $1 million grant, and they told us to go out and change the world for blind people. And we carried out trials across the world with literally thousands of blind people, asking them how we could solve their mobility problems. How could we help them to get around better? As a result, we wrote the world's first standard for audio-based navigation for people who are blind or with low vision. That's currently an American standard as well. And we've also written a standard for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And from that, we developed our app through Waymap. And we're currently rolling it out in Washington, D.C.
And would it be a layer ultimately on Google Maps? Like, I'm thinking if I put in walking directions for me from point A to point B, how might it be different with the Waymap layer, let's say?
The difference is that, first of all, it would be more accurate than Google Maps because it doesn't rely solely on GPS. In fact, it doesn't rely on signals at all if they're not there. The second thing is that it works outdoors and indoors, and Google Maps currently doesn't work indoors because it's got it works off GPS. The other thing is that our app can take you; it can integrate all of your transport journeys, both indoors, outdoors, underground, overground, and facilitate you getting to your office. In fact, even to your desk.
So how does it work if it's not with GPS? Explain the technology if you can.
So basically, we have an algorithm that turns your phone into a very accurate navigation device. We do that by using the sensors on the phone and using a system of Bayesian statistical algorithm to work out the positioning of where you are. Once we know where you are, we are able to accurately count your steps and the velocity at which you're walking, and we use that against we plot that against a known map, so a map of the indoor or outdoor area, because it's probabilistic, there are very minute errors in every calculation, right? So in for every step, we assign 5,000 possible positions to where you might be. And we use this algorithm to pick the one that's most accurate, because there would be very minute errors in that called drift. Every now and again, we would zero out those errors by using a principle of map matching, which means that we operate to up to 1 meter accuracy and 10 degree heading accuracy. So it is probably the most advanced indoor and outdoor navigation system in the world. And the thing is also, it works for people with disabilities as well as for people who don't have disabilities.
And where are you in terms of your company ARC? Is it in beta right now, or can people just access Waymap as an app right now on the Apple App Store, let's say?
As we speak right now, we're in beta. But if you come back and we speak again towards the end of the year, we were very out there working in Washington, D.C. So at the moment, we are working very hard to integrate the bus and rail and paratransit systems of the in the Washington metropolitan area, which is the tri-state area of Washington. After that, then we would be rolling it out in other cities.
So, Tom, are there some other applications that you foresee for Waymap beyond what you just described in terms of transportation needs for visually impaired people and those with intellectual disabilities?
Yes, and people in wheelchairs, and for instance, older adults who may have maybe anxiety in going outdoors, but also in short memory difficulty. But yes, is the answer. So our next step would be then to bring the great outdoors indoors. So we would be working with museums, with public buildings, with public spaces, with stadiums, sports stadiums. And for instance, in a museum environment, because we know where you are to within 1 meter, and we know where you're facing within 10 degrees, you can plot like you would plot a journey, say a trip around a big museum, say like the Smithsonian, and you want to see 17 exhibits, and then you want to go for a coffee to meet your friend. Well, you can plot 17 exhibits in, and when you're facing them, we can download the API, which will tell you what it is, give you a bit of history about it. If you think, oh God, I really didn't want to look at that, that's boring, and you turn away, it decides that you've finished and that you can walk on to your next one. And similarly in retail, it's going to help people to get. We will know if you're in the coffee aisle or the or in the aisle where all the beers, and we will also be able to help you to choose your favorite can of beer, ready to come, say next towards the middle to end next year.
So you could work with a retailer, let's say, and they could say, all right, well, the Budweiser's here and the Sam Adams is here, and we're going to point visually impaired customers to the correct beer, so they don't have to get any assistance from any buddy in the shop.
Basically, we can get you to within 1 meter of your favorite beer, and then we would just simply allow you to use your camera on your phone and just say, "This is Adam's beer," and you said, "Great, I'll have it." You know, my wife, for instance, one of the things she hates going to the supermarket for two things. You know, she's not visually impaired or disabled, So what you can do if you're sighted, and maybe it's your first time into the supermarket, or you just want to rush in and rush out, you just simply say, I want to get some bread and I want to get some marmalade or something. And you just push that in. It'll get you to the two places, and it will allow you again to select the brand that you want.
She was lying on the bed, man next door was dying, raised up his head and said, ain't she pretty, don't you know she fine. One look at that woman bring eyes to the brand. I declare she pretty and the whole state knows she fine. I declare she pretty and the whole state knows she fine. Every time she started loving, she bring eyesight to the blind.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Tom Pei. He is the CEO of Waymap. So you're a very advanced computer user, and I imagine you've been working with computers for many years. Maybe you can kind of give listeners an idea of some of the evolution, some of the big hurdles that have been accomplished in the last couple of decades to make the world more accessible for the visually impaired in terms of technology. What are some of the things that are near and dear to your heart in terms of technological breakthroughs?
I mean, I could do none of this without a very simple program called Jolt. Well, it's not a simple program, but it's a program that's been around. It's a screen reader called Jolt, and it was designed by a person who had sight problems and who wanted to be able to use a computer. Now, that means that I can access all of the data in my computer. Anything that's on the screen, my screen reader would read it to me. So I can do almost anything that I want to do on a computer. The only limitations is my ability to be able to navigate my way around. The next thing was the iPhone when it came out. It just revolutionized what blind people could do.
With like Siri and voice command?
No, absolutely. It was counterintuitive. But at the time when they were designing the iPhone, Steve Jobs said, look, we need to design this so it can be used by blind people, because if blind people can use it, everyone will enjoy it. Right? And so they brought that approach to doing the iPhone. It was counterintuitive that a blind person would be able to touch a screen and operate it like a sighted person, but it did. And it really opened the world to blind people, because now we could do outdoor navigation that we couldn't really do before, as well as having access to on-the-go communications and so on. Yeah. So those were the big things. And then, of course, with the Americans with Disabilities Act in the United Kingdom, the Disability Discrimination Act, the changes to the infrastructure, the building infrastructure and the transport infrastructure to facilitate access for everybody made a very big difference.
And when you think of the global visually impaired population, I think it's nearing the population in the United States. It's almost 300 million, I believe. And those are people with impairments. I think completely blind is more like 40-something million. For companies that didn't think this through early on, this is actually a big breakthrough for them as well, to be able to cater to a fairly significant customer base. And I can imagine it could make their operations smoother when they can, you know, just explaining what you were talking about, a shop in a store, if somebody's looking for a beer, if they can get that on their own, as opposed to trying to get a shopkeeper to come select it for them, that helps on their labor front, let's say.
It does. But the thing is that 40% of the population of the United States has some form of disability and needs some form of additional assistance. Okay. That's the first thing. The second thing is that associated with disability is a reduction in the number of times that people go out alone, and an increase in the number of times when people rely on family, friends, and others to bring them out. So, in other words, a loss of disability, and arising from that is the diminution in one's self-esteem, and from that then arrives a lot of health problems that then have to be picked up in the economy. So it's huge, just being able to get out. And as I said, when I started to think about this as a possible opportunity or business, the problem I really wanted to solve wasn't about freedom of movement. It was the freedom to explore, because the thing that I lost was not freedom of movement, because that was a right. And somebody said, why can't guide dog of my aunt, and said, there you go, Tom, right? It was my confidence, my self-imposed loss of freedom to explore the world because of the other difficulties that there were in being able to get around, like having to memorize routes, like having to, memorize getting when the bus was coming, when the train was coming. And so all of those things that one could do naturally, I couldn't do anymore. So what this does is this hands back. And that's why the phone itself becomes the instrument that is the accurate navigation device, because in your phone, you now have the freedom to explore. And because you don't have to rely on your memory to do something, you have it. The memory is all in your phone, and you can get on with it. We're just using your dog, or your cane, your wheelchair, or whatever else you need.
It sounds like you were not born without sight. You lost sight later on in life?
I lost sight when I was 39. So I was an extremely successful investment banker, and I lost my sight. And I have to say that it was cathartic. And maybe because of my personality, I over-dramatized it, and I really went into a tailspin for 4 years, until a gentleman in a charity came for me and told me that, basically I was a waste of space, and that what I needed to do was to, there were 150 blind children in this school who would never have had a job like mine. He would never get to the countries that I went to, eat the food that I'd done, earn the money that I'd earned, and so on. And that I could carry on just sorry for myself, or I could do something to help them. And it took me 3 days to get over the insult, but I went back and I actually shook hands with that man. He was the best friend ever. You know, there's people that come into your life that change your life, and he did. And ever since then, I've never looked back.
It sounds like the technology can really kind of not only close the gap between the sighted and the visually impaired, but also those who are born without sight versus those who lose sight later on in life, like yourself. I imagine somebody who becomes accustomed to the outside world and to technology at a very young age has an advantage over somebody who loses their sight in 39, kind of like somebody who's trying to learn a new language later in life. There's more challenges.
Yeah, they're almost like two disabilities, because my last charity that I ran was the Royal Society for Blind Children. And when you work with people who lost their sight in youth, the big problem is not ability. The big problem is confidence and self-belief and motivation and actually just having the courage. And courage is a maybe too complex a word, but just having that oomph to live life on life's terms. And that can be quite scary unless you are supported throughout your childhood and into your adolescence to be able to do that. And of course, because we learn 80% of what we learn through sight. And bringing up a child is a difficult thing at the best of times. Bringing up a blind child is really difficult. So unless that support is there for the family, then you get a different problem at the end. But nonetheless, it ends up with the same outcome, which is a reduction in going out, the onset of depression and anxiety and all of the things then that happened. It just happened for much longer because you're much younger.
The laws never passed, but somehow all men feel they're truly free at last. Have we really gone this far through space and time? Or is this a vision in my mind? Two.
vision in our mind.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to Tom Pei. He's the CEO of Waymap. So, Tom, we were talking about some of the technologies that have made life easier for the visually impaired and those with intellectual disabilities. We've done a lot of pieces on autonomous vehicles in SeaChange Radio, and it's almost a throwaway line for some people when they talk about it's going to also make life a little easier for those who can't drive for themselves. And from a political standpoint, we hear about, well, it's going to wipe out all the taxi drivers or the truck drivers. But looking at it from your perspective, I can't help but think this is a very exciting development, the idea that this playing field of driving may be someday level in terms of computers driving us all around. Maybe walk us through your thought process following it.
I mean, odd enough, when you talk to people who've lost their sight roughly around the time I have, and you say, what do you miss most? And you say, driving. You know, I can't drive. And I can't wait to get in, to be driven around in a self-driving car and, you know, just to kind of sit there. I kind of have this view of me sitting in an autonomous Porsche or something, but, you know, maybe something less would do. The point is that I was, you know, I'm... I think that, yes, autonomous vehicles are going to help lots of people. And yes, they're going to bring about a huge economic change in the world, and they're going to bring about great changes in society. So autonomous vehicles are going to bring about an enormous amount of social change in the world. And they're going to certainly help disabled people to get out more. They are going to help many people to get out more. And yes, you know, I said it's going to be economic upheaval for a while, or a big change, but that always happens. But, you know, you've got a great organization there called Waymo in San Francisco. And one of the things that we would love to do is to work with Waymo, for instance, because using something like a Waymap app, if we then, say, order an autonomous taxi or cab or an autonomous vehicle, that it will actually pull up within 1 meter. If you're on GPS, it could be 10 meters away on the opposite side of the road. So it might as well be on the moon.
Right. They haven't really smoothed out that wrinkle by any means. So they need another technology to connect the visually impaired to making sure that they can jump into the right taxi.
I mean, one of the things that we will develop, and we will develop that with autonomous vehicle drivers, is that, you know, because these vehicles are electric, they don't make as much noise as a fossil fuel powered car. You know, by having the interaction between my mobile phone and the car, we can maybe add an additional layer of safety.
In my baby's eyes, loving from my baby's eyes. Look up, baby, now you know damn well, love you better than another man could tell. Love you, baby, now you know I do anything in the world for you to have a loving from my baby's eyes. See, loving in my baby's eyes, see, loving in my baby's eyes, loving from my baby's.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to Tom Pei. He is the CEO of Waymap. Do you see any environmental benefits with Waymap? What are some of the ways that you think it could improve the environment?
More people will use public transport. So let me give you a really simple example. Many, many years ago, and this kind of dates me in my age, I went to see the chief executive of the Transport for London bus system. And I said to him, you know what, why don't you put in talking buses, you know, so you can make announcements that when people have arrived at their bus stop and so on. And he scratched his head. Well, he said, you've got the right time because we're changing over our guidance system. So we do it. I know it's not going to cost an awful lot extra. It actually put ridership up 8%, right? And everybody that in the industry, that were working in the industry, was saying, oh, no, it's going to drive everybody mad because it's going to have this constant talking. Actually put ridership up 8%.
I'm not surprised by that. When I lived in Japan, when I first moved there, I didn't read any Japanese. And I was always frustrated that when they didn't make an announcement or I couldn't hear the announcement of the next station. But I think that's come around. This was in the early 90s. So I've had that experience. Even though I've had sight, I was illiterate, basically.
And the same for visitors who say Washington or San Francisco or whatever, you know, that don't are not able to read signs for whatever reason, maybe because it's in English. Or the other thing is that in our trials, 87% of blind people said they would be more likely to use public transport as a result of having an app such as Waymap to help them to get around. That's an increase of 3% just from that disability alone.
That's incredible.
You know, so you can imagine the amount of people that are going to go from private transport, be it private hire vehicles or private cars, into the public transport system, massive saving in greenhouse gases.
So can people participate in the beta program now, or is that you're just hoping it'll be out to the public at the end of the year?
If you live in Washington, D.C., please contact us, www.waymapnav.com, and let us know that you would like to participate in the beta trials. We'd love to have you. Other than that, we will ask your local authorities or transport authorities to take on Waymap, and we'll come to the city near you.
Tom Pei, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Watts. Original music by Mose Allison, Stevie Wonder, and Taj Mahal. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
You're tuned to KBOO, Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series continuing Saturday, January 21st with Canadian singer-songwriter David Francy. David Francy is a Scottish-born Canadian carpenter-turned-songwriter. The Folk Music Series of concerts continues Saturday, January 21st at 7:30 in the Reed Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. The concert series continues through May. Ticket information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events.